Good morning, everyone. Okay, this is the Ethics Committee. We'll call the meeting to order. First item of business is to approve the agenda. If there are no objections, we'll consider the agenda approved as presented. Are there any objections? If none, thank you very much. The agenda is approved. Before we move on, Mr. David Horner could not join us here this morning, so Devin Rouse will be filling in for Mr. Horner and will serve on the committee this morning. So the current committee present will be obviously myself, Mr. Bulger, Mr. Goldman, and then Mr. Rouse for Mr. Horner. Okay, now we go. We'll move on to the approval of the minutes. Could I get a motion from a committee member for the approval of the minutes for the July 27th, 2019 committee meeting and the executive sessions of August 28th and September 6th? Do you want to take those separately?
Yeah, because okay. Some of us were not participating in one, but we're participating in the others.
Jennifer, can we get a ruling on that? So put a motion on the table that we approve, approve the minutes of the June 27th, 2019 committee meeting and the executive sessions of August 26, 2019 and September 6, 2019. Is there a second? Seconded by Mr. Rouse. Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, it's unanimous. So today, the committee will be considering proposed changes to the board's code of ethics. These proposed changes are designed to improve transparency, accountability, clarity, and fairness to all parties. I've asked our general counsel, Ms. Patricia Lee, and our ethics officer, Philip Staub, along with our IG, Jeff Charrington, and we'll go over the review proposed changes before us. I'm going to draw your attention to two documents. First is the Code of Ethics, which is the longer document. You'll see some red line changes there. Those are mainly, several of them are cleanup, and then others obviously will refer back to proposed and recommended changes. But the document I'd like us to really focus in on today is what we're calling the crosswalk. The General Counsel and her team have put together this document. You'll see each item where we'll have recommended changes. You'll see the current language. You'll see the proposed change. You'll see the explanation for the change and then any related changes in the code. So what I'd like to do is we'll take each of these individually. We'll have the general counsel go through each item and then we'll open it up for any questions or comments. If there are any, we'll handle those for each section instead of coming back to it, and then we'll move on to each section. So with that, Ms. Lee.
Thank you. I just wanted to give a little background of what Phil and I did in terms of putting together these recommended changes. So as the chairman said, the three things we were focused on was trying to improve transparency, accountability, and clarity. So what we did is we surveyed a dozen transit agencies and other public agencies just to understand how they conduct ethics investigations. And what we discovered is it sort of falls into two categories. Some agencies will refer it to an outside ethics commission or committee, for example, MBTA in Boston. If there's an allegation of an ethics violation of a board member, they would refer it to the state ethics commission. Sort of the other half of the dozen or so transit agencies refer to the IG. Sometimes it's an internal IG, sometimes it's an external IG, like a state IG. And so that's sort of some background on why we've recommended having the IG investigate here. And you'll see as I go through the details. We also took into consideration the June 27th letter that Mr. Smedberg, Mr. Horner, and former board member Mr. Crawford sent to the board, and there were a few recommendations in there, and we considered those and addressed as many as we thought were appropriate in the changes, okay? So if there's no questions in the beginning, I'm just going to start taking you through the crosswalk.
Does everyone have a copy of the crosswalk before that? Okay.
Okay, great. So one of the first things we did, and this was a comment that was in the June 27th letter, was to try to clarify what a conflict of interest is versus an apparent conflict of interest. And so what we did is we simplified it. So it's simply just a conflict of interest, so there's no distinction between an actual conflict versus an apparent conflict. And what we did is we just broadened the definition. And so we think it's easier to apply, and that to the extent there's any question from a board member as to whether or not you have a conflict or you may have a conflict, we strongly recommend you ask Phil or me, and we can provide guidance on that.
Are there any comments or questions on this proposed change?
Would that be in writing or telephone or email or what?
It can be both. If you okay. seek a written opinion, the ethics officer can give you that. And as the ethics code says, you can rely on a written opinion of the ethics code. So if you get a written opinion, you rely on it, you act on it, and it turns out that that was the wrong decision, that's on the ethics officer and me, not on the board member. Okay?
Mr. Dorsey.
You know, just a comment. I really appreciate what you're doing here with the crosswalk, and I think what's clear is that this abbreviated language provides greater opportunity for the ethics officials to, you know, give some definitive guidance. My concern is, however, that it the lack of detail about both real and apparent conflicts may give an ethically compromised individual this might give them cover not to even come to you in the first place, just because what I'm trying to say is when, at least with the previous language, you describe both real and apparent conflicts and created enough circumstances that presumably should cause someone to look at their relationships and bring them to you. With the reduced language, I think it may give someone who is already ethically compromised cover to say, well, I didn't see any conflict, or there was, if their conflict is apparent and not real, they may take cover in this reduced language. So that's my only concern, that this allows a bad actor to actually not come to you for the guidance that's required.
I appreciate the comment. I mean, I'd be interested if there's a specific example that...
I can. I'm not ethically compromised, yeah, so it's not an issue for me, but...
I actually think the language here is written so broadly that I would be surprised if somebody even had an inkling. Because the way the language is written, it says anything that would affect the ability of the board member to perform his or her duties fairly and objectively would be compromised. And the ability is pretty broad, so you don't even have to worry about the definition of an objective performance or anything like that or whether or not it's fair. I mean, it's pretty much if anything would compromise you being fair and objective, your ability, then it's covered. So it's a lower bar. This definition is a lower bar thing. And I appreciate your point, and I don't think there's anything that we're going to be able to draft to prevent a bad actor or somebody with corrupt intent. I mean, the idea of the code is to try to provide as much guidance to board members as possible, but it does, you know, assume good faith application in your practice and your dealings. And
that's fair. I guess what I would then maybe recommend is something, since we do the annual ethics training, that we not do the training to the limited language in the revised code, but really talk about conflicts, both real and apparent, that will go into your determination that you may in fact be compromised. I just don't want to lose this idea that there are, you know, maybe letter of the law technical conflicts, but ones that are apparent enough to be highly problematic. I don't want to give anybody cover to believe that that secondary class is not meaningful.
No, absolutely appreciate the comment, and we'll make sure that we use case type examples when we do the training. So those are defined terms?
Defined terms.
Yeah, so substantial interest or duty is actually defined in the ethics code, and we're not making, I believe we're not making a change to those definitions, did we?
We did make a change to interested party to make it broader than it was, to bring in a concept that used to be in the definition of actual conflict since it's no longer in the description of conflict itself. That was the only change to those terms.
Yeah, so substantial interest in or duty and the term interested party, their initial cap, because they're actually defined terms. Okay?
Mr. Goldberg.
I have not had really a chance to dig into this, so I'm going to be paying attention very much to the walkthrough that you're going to go through. But as I said to the chair, before we bring this to the board, I would like to have some time for it to gestate and some time for, at least on the Maryland side, for the Assistant Attorney General to have a chance to review this, since he's reviewed past bylaw and ethics code changes, and as well as for the fact that the board member, principal member, is now the Secretary of Transportation. So I just want to put that out there as a predicate to our conversation here, that I would like the opportunity to have some time after we're finished today, before we schedule a board vote for Attorney General have an opportunity to review the stuff and give his feedback to the principal and the alternate Maryland members. Having said that, just as we go through this, the question is, if you could just talk through what is the difference between a substantial interest and a duty. I know these are both defined terms, but why do we need a distinction, and what is the difference between an interest and a duty?
Yeah, the substantial interest or duty is a single defined term, and we use the term interest or duty to reflect that some of them are ownership and financial interests, and some are duties that are owed that can result in a conflict, like fiduciary duties.
So could you give an example?
Well, there are nine enumerated parts of that definition. So one example would be owning a defined amount of stock in a company. That would be a substantial interest. Being a member of a board would be a fiduciary interest.
So if you were on a nonprofit board, you wouldn't have a substantial interest, but you might have a duty?
It's one defined term, so you would have, in parlance of our code, you'd have a substantial interest or duty if you were a member of the board. So that would be pulled in to the definition of a conflict of interest.
So all the same implications throughout the document, whether it's a substantial interest or a duty. Any implications for a substantial interest or a duty are the same throughout the code. Okay, so what we've tried to do here is just streamline the way that board members can resolve a conflict of interest. Again, we've gotten rid of the distinction between actual and apparent conflict of interest, and under the existing code, an actual conflict of interest may only be resolved through recusal. An apparent conflict of interest could be resolved either through recusal or declaration. And so now that we only have one definition of a conflict of interest may be resolved either through recusal or declaration, and it'll depend on the facts and circumstances of the conflict as to which one would be appropriate. And so in Article 5, Part C1, that first paragraph is a way to facilitate board members having knowledge of what vendors or suppliers or interested parties may be relevant to an upcoming board action or to a project or to something where the board might have to make a decision. And so the secretary, when she mails out materials in advance of committee meetings and board meetings, that is to enable the board members, and it is incumbent on the board member. One of your duties is a duty of care, so you should look through the board materials and identify if you believe there may be a conflict of interest on an upcoming matter. And again, as you read through these materials, if you think maybe yes, maybe no, pick up the phone, call Phil and I, and get the guidance from us. Okay? So that's part one. Paragraph two, I think I mentioned this briefly, but again, the board members, you can rely on the ethics officer and my advice, either verbally or in writing. And so when you're making recusal decisions or whether or not you have a conflict of interest, please reach out to us if there's any question, and we can provide you guidance, and you can rely on our guidance. Nonetheless, you can rely on our guidance as well as the materials provided. If we have inadvertently left out a relevant vendor in board materials, and it turns out later on as the board is about to take an action that you've subsequently discovered in your own due diligence or what have you, that in fact there is a vendor that's relevant that you need to recuse yourself, then you should, make a statement and recuse yourself. But, you will not have violated it because you relied on our materials and you relied on the advice we gave. Nonetheless, there is a continuing obligation, even after you fill out your ethics disclosure form every year, throughout the year of service, you have a continuing obligation to raise issues of conflicts of interest if and when they arise. Okay?
Thank you, Patty. Just a kind of a clarification. If a board member recuses him or herself, does that if a recusal occurs, is it incumbent upon the board member to tell why he or she is recusing themselves?
Yes, unless there's some confidentiality that you can't breach or something. You should say somehow whatever your relationship is to whatever the project is that you need to recuse yourself from.
Will that be public?
I'm sorry?
Will that be divulged to the other board members and to staff?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So if you believe that you need to recuse yourself, you can just make the statement that there is some involvement with this vendor. You need to recuse yourself. You don't need to go into more detail if you're voluntarily recusing yourself.
Well, you just said before that it would require divulging why the person recusing themselves. Now you're saying have to do that.
No, you do need to recuse yourself. You need to if you've identified that there may be a conflict of interest, then you need to recuse yourself. The details of that conflict of interest, whatever your relationship may be to whatever the conflicted party is, you can share as much or, as little of that publicly as you wish, to the extent that you have some sort of a confidentiality obligation or duty to that other party. So if there's a project and you provide consulting services to a vendor, but you don't want to tell us the details of the types of consultant services that you're providing to that vendor, you can just say, I have a business relationship with this vendor, I'm recusing myself. That's all we need to know. I don't need to know necessarily the details of the services you provide for that vendor. Okay?
Again, I'm sorry to go through this in this detail. You've set up in C3 recusal and declaration as an either-or choice. Are there situations where recusal is mandatory?
If there's an actual conflict of interest, we will probably recommend recusal.
Well, we don't have that term anymore.
I know. And again, that's what I said, that that part of this is we would help make the determination based on the facts and circumstances of each matter. So, for example, if you owned a substantial interest, more than 50, I don't think it needs to be more than 50%, but if you owned a substantial interest in a vendor who is bidding on a WMATA contract or on a project, right, and you as a board member would take an action to approve or disapprove that project, that would be an example of an actual conflict of interest, and you would need to recuse yourself. If on the other hand, you have a relative who happens to work for a vendor, not in a procurement position, they don't own the vendor, they're just one of 10,000 employees of the vendor, and that vendor is bidding or is interested in a project, and you as a board member would vote and take action on the project, that potentially could be a situation where if the board member felt that he or she could still remain fair and objective in the vote, that declaration may be appropriate in that case. But again, it's very fact specific, right? So in that situation, if the board member's relative happens to be just, again, one of 10,000 employees, not in management, not making a procurement decision, not making, you know what I mean, then declaration may be appropriate. If that relative had a much more substantial involvement or ownership in that vendor, then that may be an actual conflict of interest.
I may be getting ahead of myself, but are those situations where recusal is mandatory set out in a section we're going to review, in a definitional section, or are those going to be matters that are going to be subject to evaluation by counsel on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah, it'll be subject to evaluation on a case-by-case basis.
I would suggest then, and I'm making more than a suggestion, that we have a series of frequently asked questions which set out some of these situations where counsel would consider a conflict, a actual conflict requiring recusal, as opposed to what are apparent conflicts that may permit someone, board member, to just engage in a declaration.
Okay. So we can provide some examples.
Set out in writing that are going to be part of the document that we'll ultimately approve.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's not a problem.
Okay, are there any other questions or comments on Article 4, Part C? Okay. Next, let's move on to Article 9, Use of Official Position, Part B2, and that's page 3 of the crosswalk.
The only change here is that we move the definition of relative to the front section on definitions. We made no other material changes. Oh. So the actual operative language is exactly the same. Okay?
Any questions or comments on this? Okay, next, Article 10, Disclosures and Acknowledgements, Part A. That's page 4 of the crosswalk.
So what we tried to do here is pretty much streamline this Article 10. After the sort of first full sentence that states when the board members have to fill out a disclosure form, nothing in that first sentence has changed, but in the next sentence, it tells you sort of what type of information is in the disclosure form, but it's not necessarily a complete listing of everything. So rather than have some of the information in the disclosure form in the ethics code, and the complete set in the disclosure form, we just took it out of here because the disclosure form speaks for itself. It asked all the types of questions that a board member needs to disclose. Okay?
Any questions or comments on this section? Okay. Next, let's move on to the Article 10, Disclosures and Acknowledgements, Part B, page 5.
So this is the process for submitting board disclosure forms to the board secretary. And again, this was just an effort to just streamline. We just thought we could say in three sentences what we previously said in a couple paragraphs. So there's no real material changes. We took some of the time frames out because we didn't think it was necessary. The Secretary's office is very prompt in getting the information to you, and Phil's very prompt in reviewing them. Okay? Yep.
I had an idea about disclosure, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
That I've been thinking about over the last few months. Let me try this out. Our appointing bodies should, in my opinion, also be told of our disclosures as like a check and balance. And this is from the District of Columbia's point of view that our Assistant General Counsel, who you probably know, Patty, we have conference calls all the time, would also receive the disclosures, and in case of a red flag, he or she would disclose to you if something was awry. Just a check and balance idea.
So each of the appointing authorities, as with the public, can ask for copies of the disclosure form, or you're asking for that to be a requirement, an affirmative requirement of the board secretary's office, or upon request?
I don't know bureaucratically how it would be handled. I'm just saying that our disclosures should be also vetted with our appointing body.
I mean, as a board member of a jurisdiction, you're always free to provide your own disclosures.
Yeah, but it's voluntary.
To your appointing authority.
Well, right now we don't.
You can.
You could. I didn't even know that.
Yes, you may.
I did not know. Nor, yes. Well, I'm just trying to cut through it, saying let's just send our disclosures to our appointing body as a check and balance.
Yeah, each board member may share his or her disclosure form with his or her appointing jurisdiction.
I think Mr. Boulder has a good idea, but I think the kind of review by the attorney generals of the jurisdictions would be something that they should recommend as a change coming back if there's uniformity in this. So I'm sure that's something that the Maryland AG will want to consider, because I think it is an interesting idea, an interesting proposal.
If for no other reason, they may or may not know more than we know about disclosure. Now, it's a possibility.
Okay. I mean, any of the jurisdictions wants to make that proposal, we're happy to consider it.
But just to be clear, though, that can be done right now without any changes to anything that we want to do, either by a board member, him or herself, or the appointing authorities, them or themselves. So
right.
We don't need to change anything at WMATA to actually effectuate what you want.
I don't know if that's – well, I'll ask the question. I don't know if that's correct. If the public – requests a disclosure statement, a disclosure statement would be provided through a PERP request, am I correct?
It doesn't, not typically. So the Secretary's office will redact disclosure statements for privacy and then make them available with knowledge of the board members.
Right.
We don't make the public go through a PARP request necessarily. It just depends. But typically our practice has been to be, fairly transparent, and if there's a request made, we get them almost every year, and we would redact them for privacy and then release them to the public.
Right, but that was the point I was getting at, that what's provided is a redacted copy of the financial disclosure statement. So I would think the appointing authorities, if they wanted or requested, would want an unredacted copy. So they would have all the information that may require some affirmative action.
But I guess what I'm saying is they can always require that of the people that they appoint.
Right.
You're making this more complicated than it needs to be.
That is true. It's not another option available to them.
Yeah, and the redactions are really, again, it's just for privacy. If you name your children and where they go work or go to school, we'll redact that just to protect your family's privacy. I mean, very little else is redacted from the forms.
Would you redact percentage ownerships or specific holdings, names of specific holdings?
No. Oh, you can respond.
We have redacted, like, number of shares of stocks held, because the point in the disclosure is that if it's being reported, it's over the threshold in the code of ethics. So we know it's over 3% or 15,000.
But they don't need to know the exact amount. Okay?
Okay. Thank you, Tom and Michael, for those comments. Any other questions on this section? Okay. Next, Article 13. So really want to pay attention here. The Ethics Committee, Part C-1. This is where we have some significant
changes. Yes. So this section deals with what the Ethics Committee would do if it received a allegation that a board member either may have violated the ethics code or that there was a conflict of interest that he or she didn't disclose and acted on. And so in this first section here on page 6 of the crosswalk, the chair of the Ethics Committee, upon receiving a report or an allegation of a potential ethics violation or conflicts of interest, the chair of the Ethics Committee would promptly schedule an executive session to consider the report of the suspected violation. And the board member whose conduct is alleged to potentially violate the ethics code would be given a notice and an opportunity to be heard. Okay, and then the next section, which is 13C2, so in that executive session meeting of the Ethics Committee, the Ethics Committee would consider, I guess, two routes, if you will. If the issue that is brought before the Ethics Committee can be resolved promptly, and promptly means within 5 business days, then the affected board member would be told the remedial action, that he or she would have to take that within 5 business days, and that would resolve the matter. That resolution would be public, and it would be kept with the secretary's office. And let me give you an example of something that can be resolved promptly. Say somebody, the board or the board secretary's office, gets an anonymous call or something that they believe there's an action coming up, that the board's about to take action, and they have information that that board member, credible information that that board member may have a substantial interest or duty in a vendor. That is something that we could, that is something that the affected board member, if it is true that he or she has a substantial interest, could, before the board action, update his or her disclosure form and then recuse him or herself from the action. So that's something that could be resolved promptly within 5 business days. If it's something more than that, then our recommendation, and if you go to the next section, is to refer the matter to the IG for investigation. Okay?
Okay. Comments or questions, Mike?
So this process does not change the current provisions where the Ethics Committee is composed of 4 members, being the members of the Executive Committee, except that if a member that is accused of a violation is on the executive committee, he or she is replaced by another member from his jurisdiction.
That doesn't change.
That doesn't change.
Right.
And I may be getting ahead of myself again here, but this assumes a majority vote by the ethics committee to take an action. Is that correct? Because as if the matter can be resolved. So resolution requires an action by the ethics committee. Mm-hmm. So that would require a majority vote. So my question is, what provision addresses the situation that the last ethics committee investigation experienced where there's a tie vote? So there's no majority that can take an affirmative action by the ethics committee. How is that addressed in these revisions?
Well, I mean, if, for example, in my first example, that 2 board members of the Ethics Committee felt like the matter could be promptly resolved and the other two couldn't, then it should get go to the full board.
Then it gets kicked up to the full board?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so unresolved that
section,
matters.
That section still remains.
That's not a section we've talked about yet,
no,
correct?
Because we didn't change that. Yeah. It's in 13C. Hold on. You would have thought I memorized this whole thing by now. it's 13C. I think it's in D. So in 13, in the new 13C3, unless the matter can be promptly resolved as described above, then the Ethics Committee will refer the matter.
But again, that takes a vote of the Ethics Committee to refer, doesn't it?
No. No.
Well, how does the Ethics Committee refer if it doesn't have a majority vote in favor of referral?
Because you've already said that it's conditional. It's an if-then. So... unless the matter can be resolved immediately within 5 business days, if it cannot be, then it will be referred. There doesn't have to be a vote. So if the Ethics Committee can't decide whether or not the matter can be resolved promptly, it goes to the IG.
Have you given any consideration to having a 5-member Ethics Committee so that there is not a potential in the future for ties?
We could, right? Is that a bylaws change?
Yeah, we would have to change the bylaw. The ethics code currently says 4. The bylaws do say that all the committees are 4, but it does say except for the executive committee. And the executive committee is the ethics committee, so you could, if the ethics committee chose to, have the committee be 5 people.
I would certainly advocate you're looking at that, since that was one of the, I guess, the big problems we noticed experienced in the last ethics committee investigation. I mean, I think it would be good to try and resolve that so that never happens again.
Yeah, no. I agree.
Okay. I mean, that's something that, again, it's up to the Ethics Committee and ultimately the board. There is a way to get to 5 if you want to get to 5. Okay.
Let me just throw it out there. Would there be any jurisdictional concerns? Whom would make the determination of who serves in the role of that particular person?
You could flip a coin, or you could go on seniority.
Okay. We'll,
yeah, I mean, it's absolutely possible. We wouldn't even, you know, we would just amend the code. I think the code currently says it's 4 members, but we can easily make it 5. And the bylaws contemplate that the Ethics Committee can be more than 4.
I mean, okay. I think you could come back to us with a couple ideas like Tom's as how the 5th person should be chosen.
Selected.
Yeah. I mean, we will eventually have to decide that, I guess, for purposes of the bylaw change, so we should have some choices to consider. Flipping a coin is an interesting option.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, will you indulge? Oh, Mr. Chairman, got it. I'm sorry. I'm in the last committee. You indulge. It looks as though the Ethics Committee has 5 days, and then at that point, the Ethics Committee no longer has a role other than to receive a briefing. So Ethics Committee doesn't resolve within 5 days. IG, you know, therefore, by definition, it's more complicated, and the IG needs to look at it. IG reports back to the committee, but there's no role for the committee to do anything because the question then go straight to the board, correct?
A couple things there. So the 5 days, the 5 business days, is for the affected member to correct or remedy the conflict. If the ethics committee takes longer than five, the ethics committee can take longer than 5 days to decide whether or not they think the affected member could just resolve it within 5 days.
So the clock for prompt resolution starts when the ethics committee has determined what they think the appropriate resolution is?
When that has been communicated to the affected member.
Okay.
So when the affected, you know, if the ethics committee says...
I was tripping over the definition of prompt resolution when that clock started. Thank you.
So the 5 business days, I know the word promptly is... Okay.
I asked the same question.
Okay. And I think this question has come up to me before about the role of the ethics committee. So with respect to investigations, yes, the role of the ethics committee has been reduced slightly from the way it is currently, from its role under the current ethics code. But the ethics committee also has other roles, you know, I mean, to play, such as to ensure that the code is up to date, to ensure that everybody has training, to deal with other matters like that. And so I don't think it diminishes the overall value of the ethics committee. It just diminishes the role the ethics committee plays vis-a-vis an investigation. Okay.
Did we do C3? I had a question on C3, or have we completed that, or is that still the appropriate?
We haven't gotten there yet. We're still on C1, C2.
C1, C2.
So any final questions or comments on those two sections? Is everyone generally okay with the concept that has been put forward? Okay. Seeing heads nod there. Okay. Now let's go to Article 13, Ethics Committee, Part C.3. That's page 8 of the crosswalk.
Okay, so... again, if the matter cannot be resolved promptly, then the board will refer the matter to the IG for investigation. The IG will promptly investigate and then brief the ethics committee and provide a summary written report of the findings. Any questions about that? Because the IG actually has some changes to that. He wanted to put in a little bit more specificity as to what his role would be or his office's role would be in the investigation and some parameters around that. So Phil's going to walk around and give you copies of the proposed language. And I'll read through it, but I thought it'd be easier if you just saw it on paper.
And again, this is new, so you're not seeing anything in the current
right,
section.
It's not in the crosswalk.
So again, this is another addition to a revise the ethics code.
We are on, are you looking at the document we just handed you? Yes, that is Article 13 C3, number 3, where you see, yeah, you see the red lines. Did you get the ball? Yeah, great. Okay, Mr. Charrington, feel free to chime in as I go through this to the extent you want to elaborate on anything. Again, so this is where under C2, the matter was not able to be resolved promptly, then the Ethics Committee refers it to the Inspector General. Now, the Inspector General will consider whether or not his office could take the matter, and the Inspector General may decline to investigate for either, you know, for reasons of independence or conflicts. And that is at the discretion of the Inspector General. If the Inspector General declines to investigate, then the Ethics Committee will retain outside counsel to conduct the investigation. At the conclusion of either the Inspector General or outside counsel's investigation, the investigatory body will brief the Ethics Committee and provide a written summary directly to the full board. Okay? And then the remainder of the red lines at the bottom of that paragraph three are things that the Inspector General just wanted to make clear that that office's investigation is going to be conducted pursuant to its own policies and procedures, and it's in the Inspector General's discretion what he or she chooses, he right now, chooses to include in the written summary. Yes.
Clarification. Jeff, summary versus full report. What do you think? I think summaries leave things out.
Now, I appreciate that, Mr. Bulger. One of the reasons that I wanted to stress, we're going to conduct these investigations in the same manner with the same practices, policies, procedures as we do all other OIG investigations. We write a report of investigation with attachments. That's what we do now. That's what we plan to do. Whether we call that or you call that a summary report or otherwise, we're going to provide you with the exact same report that we would do in an administrative investigation that I would provide to the general manager so that he and his staff could take action.
So, Patty, should we change the word summary to whatever Jeff's appropriate language is?
Well, it just depends on if it's so the reason it's a the word summary is in there is that oftentimes when there's an investigation, there might be information in there that is subject to the Privacy Act, that may be subject to grand jury 6C confidentiality requirements, that may have attorney-client privilege communications. And so those could be taken out of a full report, and that report could be called a summary report. That's the reason the word summary is in there, because the intent is whatever that report is will be public.
Just for clarification purposes, it really goes back to we'll use the same policies, procedures, and practices. If tomorrow the OIG decides to change the verbiage from report of investigation to summary report of investigation, we're still providing you the exact same product we would provide in all of our OIG products and work so that it remains independent. It's not special for the board. It's done with the same manner that we do everything else.
And even with the IG's current reports of investigations, those are still reviewed for privacy and privilege and other concerns, other privilege rights that the authority may have before they're released publicly. And that's what would happen in this case.
So just for this, really, summary, I know we're wrapping ourselves around the axle about that word. This is really to distinguish between something that has been packaged in such a way versus a bunch of raw data. Is this the general intent here?
Yeah, and it's really to protect privacy information, okay, the attorney-client privilege, any grand jury 6E information that might have been discovered during the investigation. That would come out. That's why the word summary is in there. You could say redacted, but it's really a summary is, I think, a more elegant way of saying this is information that's going to go to the board that can be released to the public.
Right.
Just a question on the last sentence, maybe for clarification or maybe a suggestion. The Inspector General will brief the Ethics Committee and then provide the board. Can we add there the concept of promptly provide the board or upon conclusion immediately provide the board with the summary written report? I assume that was the intention.
Yeah, that's fine. We can put the word promptly after the word then.
Yeah.
And then promptly provide the board. Are you okay with that?
The other question is written summary report. I don't know, so I'll ask the question. Is this a public report that's going to the board at this point? I think it's a public report subject to redactions approved by the general counsel or some concept like that, so we're clear, you know, what we're getting, that we're obviously not getting. Well, that, I guess that is the question. are we getting, as board members, the full report, or would board members be getting a redacted report, or would the public document that goes out in the public domain just be redacted, and the board members would get the full report?
Jeff would like to, Mr. Chair, would like to answer that.
We don't make our reports of investigation public. If they're parped, then they go through the redaction process and they're made public. In this instance, we could provide a public report summarizing things that we could summarize, but I would feel more comfortable if I briefed the board in the same manner that I would brief the general manager or any federal inspector general would brief the department secretary in private with a private report of investigation that could be parped. In other words, it's not completely secretive. But if we were to provide a report in the manner that we do audit reports or evaluation reports that go public, it would then be a summary report. I didn't mean to confuse it anymore, but that would go against our practice because we do not publicize reports of investigation.
Well, I think that's why we need to be clear what we're getting here. I think the intention here is that there's a public document that's out in the public domain from whoever is doing the investigation, whether it's the IG or whether it's outside counsel. So we have to figure out some way.
I'm happy to put the word public in front of the word summary.
Well, how do we then get it from the IG?
Well, then he would produce a public summary report of his ROI.
All right, so
the ROI
would,
is kept private.
That would be somewhat an exception to the general IG policy and practices in providing reports.
Yes, but we would make that exception if we were asked to or if it made sense to do that, so it doesn't violate our practice.
Mr. Russ.
I think this is important because, with IG reports, there are some evidence that could be discovered that, let's say it has to go to prosecution. You don't want that to be disrupted, right, that process. But given, the particulars here, I think the transparency aspect is important. So you don't want to leave it for the public to believe that we're not trying to be transparent, but you're trying to protect what needs to be protected for other reasons and then be up front with what's going on at the same time in the manner that you can. So I do think it's important to have some form, in this case, some form of a summary available so people are at least aware of what's going on and that we're not trying to put anything behind the veil.
Public session. So, in effect, it would be
the
public
report, right?
Yeah.
Because you're going to be discussing the summary report in public session, which is the next section of the crosswalk.
Yeah. Okay. Before we move on, so we have two, three. Mm-hmm. Any other final comments or questions for now?
Mr. Chair.
Good discussion, Mr. Gray.
So I think probably what that'll lead to is what does that mean? A summary report, you read through the summary, and now people are seeking clarification with regards to what's redacted or what they feel may be left out. What would the response of the board be in that case?
I mean, so the materials that would be redacted would, again, be privacy, attorney-client privilege, any confidential 6E grand jury information, and or anything else. I mean, there might be, I'm trying to envision other situations where there might be national security or safety information that we would want to redact.
And I'm fine with that.
Yep.
That, to me, that's kind of the natural progression of the questions. And, my background is HR, and I think you've done a really good job with this, what I've seen thus far.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to make an addition to that. Just like we do in all of our cases, I'll just give you a brief scenario. Let's say that we're conducting an administrative investigation. We come across potential criminal allegations. Okay, we're going to refer those to the prosecutor, be it the United States Attorney or local prosecutor. As we do in all our cases, we'll work with the prosecutor. Should it come to that point, and that is then cloaked in 6E grand jury or any other criminal investigation, we'll be the ones to bring that forward to say, we can no longer discuss this, so then the onus is on the OIG that we have to keep it secret, and it's not as if the board doesn't want to make it public. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
just as we do today. I have to tell the general manager often that, you know, look, it's now a criminal case. We can tell you what we can tell you, i.e. the management alerts that we mentioned earlier, so long as it doesn't disrupt the investigation or take away from the integrity of the investigation. But then we'll be the ones to be able to state, we can't talk about that.
And just so the committee members and other board members are aware, we did, Patty and myself, did meet with Philip, did meet with Jeff early on with his counsel to discuss, you know, these new procedures, just so you're aware of that. So we did have a meeting.
Okay. All right. So I think we're on D now, 13D.
Yep. Okay. That's page 9.
Yeah. It's page 9 of the... of the crosswalk. And so this basically, so the IG or the outside counsel has now completed his or her investigation, has briefed the ethics committee, has provided the public written summary report to the full board. The board then needs to convene a public session and discuss that report and discuss what, if any, sanctions, if they found a violation, what, if any, sanctions the board feels is appropriate for the affected board member. And again, that would all be in public session, and the second paragraph of Part D is that the board has to make a written determination, so there needs to be a board resolution. There will actually be a formal board action with regard to what the board found, and if the board found a violation, what the sanctions are that the board imposed. Okay.
Any comments or questions, Mr. Goldman?
I'm sorry. I guess two questions. The first is, does the board at this level have the ability to go into executive session to consider sanctions policies or sanctions options before going into a public session to have a vote?
Yes.
So this does not require that everything be done in a public session at this
but
point.
But that there must be one. There needs to be a public session. You can meet in executive session a couple times before if you're discussing, you can't agree on a particular sanction or something like that. But again, you know, we were trying to, in light of the desire of this board to improve the code and improve transparency, it must end with a public session, a public vote, and a public board resolution. And we've removed the section of we're proposing to remove the language in the ethics code that permitted the board previously or the ethics committee previously from just closing a matter without going public with it. So that's now been deleted.
And the follow-up question there is, In this structure of board deliberation, either public or executive section, what is the status of the board member accused of a violation? Is he or she precluded from participating? Is he or she precluded from voting? What is, I don't know if this is addressed in another section of your revisions, but what is the status of the board member accused of a violation when a matter is brought before the board?
So that board member cannot participate in any sessions that deal with the investigation of him or herself, because he would be recused because he or she's conflicted. That board member could still participate because no action has been taken against that board member. There's only been an allegation of wrongdoing. So until the board acts, that board member could still carry out his or her duties to vote on other matters that are completely unrelated to the investigation.
Right, but I don't think you're addressing the two specific concerns I have or questions I'm raising. Okay. When the board sits in executive session deciding the fate of the board member, I mean, normally the accused does not participate in the jury's deliberation or the judge's
right.
deliberation. Are we clear that he or she would not participate?
Yes, and that's already clear in the existing language in the ethics code now,
okay.
And we haven't changed that.
And when we actually have a vote
on what sanction or whether there has been a violation with that board member. Does he or she participate in deciding his or her own fate?
No.
So he or she is precluded by what basis? Is there a provision?
Yes, there is.
Does that in...
Well, it's first of all, it's a conflict of interest. So he or she cannot vote, so he or she would be precluded.
This is a difficult issue even
for that.
DC Council to decide in a recent event.
One, it would be a conflict, but two, there's the section in the Ethics Code that we did not change where if the affected member happens to be the chair, then the affected member would have to recuse from those matters and the first vice chair. So if you read that section plus the conflict of interest sections, those two sections make clear that the affected board member cannot participate and cannot take action on any matters vis-a-vis him or herself with respect to the investigation.
So in the earlier stages before you get into IG involvement, is one of the ways that a matter can be resolved promptly is if a 3-1 or 4-0 majority of the ethics committee finds that the allegation has no merit or does not constitute a violation of the code, does that, I guess, where's the off-ramp from all of the stuff involving Jeff and the full board?
If there's a finding that there is no, that either the allegation has no merit or that you don't even think there's a violation and therefore it doesn't need to be resolved promptly because there's nothing to resolve, yes, the board, the ethics committee can make that finding, but it needs to be public. Right. So, right. C2. So C2 says if the matter can be promptly, can be resolved promptly. The example, the such as by requiring, is just an example. If the matter can be promptly resolved because the ethics committee has determined that there's no merit, that's another way of promptly resolving it. But the important sentence at the end is the ethics committee determination will be maintained by the board secretary and made public. Would you like me to add language that? Okay. That's what that section says if you think it's not sufficiently clear. Because the such as is for example, not exclusive of other things that the ethics committee could determine can be promptly resolved, such as a finding of no violation. I mean, I can add that as an example, such as requiring that, such as finding of no violation. Do you want me to add that? Okay. 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 Yeah.
We'll go ahead and add that.
Add that as an example.
So on 13, Part D, any other final comments or questions? Generally, people okay with the procedures outlined here in the proposal? Seeing nodding of heads. Okay. Next, Article 16, effective date duration amendment.
Right.
So this is cleaning up some stuff.
It is, yeah. Yes. The only thing we've done here is the current language says that the Ethics Committee is supposed to review the Ethics Code every year, and so we've just changed it to the Ethics Committee can review and amend the code as deemed necessary or appropriate. So anytime throughout the year, if you feel like, you know, in a particular year, you needed to look at it twice for whatever reason, we just didn't see the reason for that restriction. And that's the only change we made. OK? Okay? All right.
That's it. Any other comments, questions?
Well, haven't you changed the form?
Yes.
And moved things?
We didn't move things to the form. We've conformed the language in the form to reflect some of the proposed changes here, and we added a couple more questions in the form to try to help board members disclose things that should have been disclosed that may not have been clear in the prior form.
Can you just go through and summarize what those changes are in the form? So we're essentially seeing a different form next year than
had
this year.
Again, some of the changes are, again, just conforming changes, cleanup changes for language and clarity. The two biggest changes are in part two of the form, where it talks about employment, fiduciary positions, and personal representation. So we've added a subpart B that is now required to be disclosed, and this is interested parties from which employers receive revenue. And so this would be a situation, again, where you work for a consultant company, and you know the consultant company has clients that are vendors. Previously, it wasn't clear that you had to disclose that because it's a sort of one step removed, right? So you work for a consultant company. The consultant company is not a vendor of WMATA, but the consultant company has a client who is a vendor of WMATA, and you're providing consultant services to a WMATA vendor. That would be a situation that is now covered under B that wasn't previously covered. We thought it was covered, but it wasn't clear that it was covered, so we wanted to make that an explicit requirement to disclose now. Okay? So that's one change.
So and even if it's under 3% of the employer's gross, but it is more than $10,000, it should be listed in B. That's
correct. Yeah. Looking at the form, I have page 3 of the form. It's part 2, the new red line, section B.
And I'll just say, I think the intent here is to address the issues that we've had in the past. And it creates more responsibility on the board member to
do this one.
And, you know, does it leave any wiggle room or anything?
And that what I don't see is a requirement to list every client of a board member's law firm.
Right.
Exactly.
But rather interested parties who happen to be.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, and then one other material change to the disclosure form. Phil will talk about this. It's in... Is it 2 or?
Part 2. It's on the next page of the form. And basically all these are better reflecting what's been in the code. As Patty was saying, the part B that was added, interested parties from which employers and businesses, which you'll see later, receive revenue, that is a substantial interest or duty is defined in the code. This wasn't specifically called out in the form before, so now it's there specifically. Same thing with personal representation. That is a type of substantial interest or duty. It just wasn't called out specifically. So now we provide a space for the board member to do that as to interested parties again.
Okay. So that's it. Those were really the two material changes we added to the disclosure form.
Just to be clear, I guess D refers to you or a household member, which then takes you back to the definition of household member.
Yes.
And I just want to be clear that that to be a household member, you have to be living in the member's household. So there's a grown child that is
living outside of the household is not considered a household member.
Right. Children specifically need to be living in the household. So a child not living in the household is not a, defined as a household member in our code. That's correct. Thank you.
Any other final comments or questions? All right, so I think given the conversation we just had and the comments, I think it's best I'll work with Patty and Philip. We'll make these changes. We'll bring this back in a couple of weeks so we have a clear copy. Michael, if you could, get that to your contact in the AG's office, right. Have that person, do whatever they have to do. And then we'll bring back the clean copy, if you will, to the committee. And then at that point, the intent would be to vote on something to move forward to bring to the board.
So right. Just to be clear, you're going to come up with a revised document.
Yep.
And that's the document that I'll ask the Attorney General to look at, correct?
Yeah, I think this we can turn around.
Well, that's pretty quick. Sure.
Pretty absolutely. Quickly. Yeah. Does that sound good to folks?
Yeah.
Members? Okay. I think that's it. So if there's no other business, Jennifer, go ahead.
The exact
session. Okay, so this meeting of the Ethics Committee is adjourned. If there's no further business, we'll go ahead and request an executive session. So in accordance with the bylaws, I pass.